Da han hørte hvilke ord som kom ut av munnen hennes, hoppet hjertet hans over et slag, og et sug i magen fikk han til å legge ned McFrysen han var på vei til å spise. For han så på henne at hun mente det hun sa. Men han spurte likevel om hun var sikker, og hun nikket unnskyldende. Men egentlig så hun ikke trist ut i det hele tatt, men letta. Og da hun nikket av restauranten, tenkte han på hva han skulle ønske han hadde sagt. Og det er sånne ting som gjør at folk sitter her og gråter noen ganger. Men sånn er livet. Og McDonald's er bare en liten del av det, tross alt.
Nå er det endelig helg hos Meny, og denne helgen får du 30% rabatt på et stort utvalg burgere, bøkerøkte sommergoteletter til 79,90 per kilo, 500 gram Civita-druer til 29,90, og 30% rabatt på et stort utvalg Toro bakemikser, både i butikk eller levert hjem. Meny, spiser du bedre, lever du bedre.
En podcast fra Podplay.
Hei og velkommen til episodesamtalene Naturlig Intelligens, der vi snakker med mennesker som smartere enn oss selv. Ikke så vanskelig, tenker du, og det helt greit. Vi prøver å høre om deres tanker, erfaringer og følelser, og hvordan de kan være med å ta verden i riktig retning. Jeg heter Gjermund Strømberg Eriksen, og Erik Bergsen fikk en liten hilsen fra Washington, som lykke til med disse samtalene før vi kommer til Stuart.
Natural intelligence. Congratulations, Norway, you finally got the podcast that spreads the massage. Message, sorry, Mr. Bergersen. Well, congrats, Air Force One out, I guess.
Stuart Stevens chief strategist, og mest kjent for oss i Norge, som den som ledet Mitt Romneys presidentvalg. Men han jo da den mestvinnende republikanske strategen de siste 30 årene i president, guvernør, senat og kongressvalg, også på delstatsnivå. Han leder da, når han gjør en presidentvalgkamp, det vanskeligste og største som kan gjøres i kampanjeverden. Det vil si strategi, budskap, reklame, surrogatplan på bakkenoperasjoner i alle delstater de nødvendig og kjøper kvantitativ og kvalitativ research løpende hver dag og evaluerer hva gjør vi og hva sier vi i hvilke kanaler og til hvilken tid hver eneste dag. Han et vandrende oppslagsverk i alt som har preget og påvirket det republikanske partiet, og han har møtt de personlige og jobbet for mange av disse legendariske menneskene som vi var skeptiske til før vi fikk Donald Trump, og nærmest savner alt som var før 2014. Stuart på det som kalles et redemption plot, hvor han angrer på ganske mye han har vært med på i republikanske parti, i hvordan han har spilt på frykt og utnyttet svakheter i den konstruksjonen. I den siste boka, The Conspiracy to End America, så det jo et oppgjør med alle de fem viktigste elementene du trenger for å demontere demokratiet, og hvordan de samlet i det republikanske partiet, og hvordan de linjene går tilbake til tidlig 2000, 90, 80, 70, 60, 50-tallet, i en utrolig godt fortalt historie. Boka før der, It Was All A Lie, tar for seg rasismens historie i USA og hvordan det har vært den underliggende nerven som har preget de fleste hovedvalgene det republikanske partiet har tatt, og hvordan det utnyttet for å vinne valg på alle nivåene, og hvordan Stuart var med på å gjøre det. Donald symptomet, GOP da det store problemet. Så kan vi jo spørre oss hvordan de kan skilles fra hverandre der vi står i dag. Vel, her kommer samtalen. Jeg anbefaler lydboka på det sterkeste. En utrolig godt lest bok og opplevelse, og retorisk, og for så vidt også en litterær prestasjon. Moro det, ja, jeg har vært fan av Stuart lenge, og lenge før han tok avstand fra det republikanske partiet, altså, bare så alle skjønner det. Det en enorm prestasjon vi kampanjelederne gjør, og det de øverste og dyktigste praktikantene av faget jeg har prøvd å nerde meg ned i hver dag med mye krefter fra 2001. Stuart Stevens, it's an honor for me to have you on this podcast and to get to do an interview. Can you please just tell the Norwegian audience where you are in Sweden so they can geographically, for those who knows geography, understand that you do this voluntarily? You went to Sweden.
Yes, I love Sweden. I love Norway. I am in Bruksvallene, Sweden, which is only about 30 kilometers from the Norwegian border.
What's the most...
Very, very beautiful here.
What's the strangest things about Swedish people that you like coming back to?
Well, more people speak English in Sweden than they do in America. So that's always...
Yeah. But, have you met people without the... Have you met people without the accent of some guy trying to find mass destruction weapons in Iraq? Do you have found the one Swede without the accent?
Right. Well, you know, one out of every four Swedes at one point moved to America. And where they moved is very interesting. Where Scandinavians moved, you can look at American voting records, and it is the highest turnout percentage in elections.
Whoa.
They're very good citizens.
And well, vote. My relatives are Trumpists and really, and so they are, maybe they're good citizens, but they are joining the team of your book on the wrong side. Hey, I mean, one very particular part of the presidential election campaign that you were heading up, Mitt Romney, is a very relevant in my brain these days. And it is probably the thing that I think Obama was wrongest about in the debate when he was lecturing Mitt Romney about Russia not being a threat. How did you think about that statement then? Well, and how have that statement evolved on you?
You know, it's so they had three debates, and the third one essentially was a foreign policy debate. So this is October 2012. So before the debate, I was asking myself, like, does anybody really care about foreign policy? So we did a poll. I had a poll done. And less than 7% of the electorate listed foreign policy as one of their top 10 issues, which is sort of amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think if you go back and you look at what Mitt said about Russia and called them the number one geopolitical foe, which Romney is, well, he's a brilliant guy, and he's very precise about language. He studied English. He's a very good writer, very good editor. And he carefully used the word foe versus threat. And to his distinction was you could look at Iran, a nuclear Iran, as a threat, but in a global strategic sense, Russia was more of a foe because Russia was more committed to expanding what was, you know, recreating the Soviet Union, and to destabilizing democracy. So I don't really know in the history of American debates, has there ever been a single phrase that or moment that turned out to be as prescient? This was before Russia...
invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, interfered in Ukraine, interfered in Brexit, which they did. I mean, in all likelihood, Brexit would not have passed without Russian help. It was before they invaded Crimea, Ukraine. It was before they invaded Georgia. It was before they interfered for Trump in the 16 elections. And, you know, I don't understand why we don't talk about this more. And in one sense, there's a very simple through line to American politics now.
Yeah.
Russia wanted Donald Trump elected.
And it's a massive underestimation of, and actually a wrong analysis. What is Putin's want and needs? And that it is not aligned with anything that resembles what NATO wants, EU wants, and the part of the US election that are pro-democracy with little d. When did you see that this analysis is totally wrong? Because Mitt Romney described him as a foe, but yes. not as an anti-democracy kind of foe, I felt back then. When did you see this is heading in the really wrong direction? Well, was that before Trump came down the escalators, or describe
look, they invaded Georgia, yep. They went into Syria as Assad's mass murderers. The Obama administration famously gave Syria a red line not to cross, that they used chemical weapons.
I think that's the second sentence he regrets most in his election, that it in foreign
Syria,
policy.
Did it. We did nothing. Invaded Ukraine, and we did very little. But what's really interesting about this is there was no reason in an election in October of 2012 to believe that anybody really cared about foreign policy, like I said. And there was no reason to believe that what Mitt Romney was saying about Russia would get him any votes. And yet he said it because he believed in it. And, publicly, I think when you go back and you look at the attacks that were made on him by the Democratic establishment, Madeleine Albright apologized to Romney later. But I think
I do it often inside me.
as wrong as it could have been.
Yeah.
Now, the honesty, I kind of give them a break on that because, look, I've been in a million campaigns. You pretty much say whatever you think will help you in a campaign. Mm-hmm. And it's I think you get a certain pass. But I think that there was a tremendous naivete about the Obama administration when it came to Russia.
Yeah. So that's a setup of we're going to get back to your book. That is about conspiracy to end America, the democracy part of America. But you are a chief strategist, you're a writer, you're a campaign worker, you're an ad man, and you're a TV series writer as well. And you write fiction and nonfiction, novelist, and these brilliant nonfiction books about American politics. Couldn't you just say that, give us a hint on how you felt going into politics when you were studying in LA, the film school? I don't know, remember if you were studying to be a director or a writer, but I love the writer part.
I grew up in the American South in Mississippi at a time when civil rights was still very much an issue. It still is. But, when people were getting killed and murdered and tortured to stop Black people from voting, the period really captured in Mississippi Burning.
Fantastic movie.
Which they filmed in my hometown. So I first got involved in politics when a friend of my parents, who they had gone to university with, was running for governor. And there really only were Democrats then. So he was running in the Democratic primary. And he was running against the last avowed segregationist who won in Mississippi. And he was a moderate on race. It really wouldn't be fair to characterize him as a liberal. I'm not really sure what a liberal on race would be. But he was an anti-segregationist.
That's on the positive side.
Yeah. So as a result, he got a lot of death threats from the Ku Klux Klan. And I have this very vivid memory of, I was maybe 13 or so. And like most candidates for governor, they don't have Secret Service protection. No candidates for governor have Secret Service protection. And there was a group of former law enforcement types, some off duty, who travel with him to protect him. because this is a time in Mississippi when people were getting killed over civil rights a lot. My father was an attorney, but he had been an FBI agent. And he traveled some with this candidate to kind of try to help him with security. And I remember this very vividly, being in a high school locker room on a Friday night, and he was supposed to go out and give a speech in this high school football stadium. And there had been this very specific threat that if he went out and gave this speech, he would be shot. And I'm just a kid watching this. And my father and these other men were trying to convince him not to give the speech. And this guy's name was William Winter. He's a very tough guy. And he said, no, I'm going to give the speech. And one of the guys went out to the car and came back with like this bulky bulletproof vest that they had then. And he put it on under his jacket. My father and others went out to their cars and they came back with rifles. And my father...
And this is a political rally. This is still not...
A political rally, yeah. My father had fought 3 years in the South Pacific. And like most of those guys, he never really talked about it, but he hated guns. And, you know, for him to go out and get a rifle and come back and put it under his long coat and go out there. And I thought it was, and he gave the speech. And it later came out that there was someone there who was intending to shoot him and probably didn't because he had security. So I thought it was the bravest thing I'd ever seen in my life.
It's beautiful.
I thought, if this was politics, how could you not want to be part of it? So, you know, I'd always been interested really in three things: politics, film, and writing. I studied English, and then I went to film school. And when I was in film school, I had been what they call a page. I'd worked in a congressional office when I was in high school. And that congressman was running for the U.S. Senate, and his chief of staff was running for Congress. And he had been my boss, and he called me and asked me if I could make commercials for him, because he really couldn't afford to hire anybody. And I said, that's great. I just don't know how to make commercials. And he goes, figure it out. So I ended up making commercials for him, and he ended up winning. One of those things, not because of the commercials, but just because he was the right person at the right time. And then I discovered that people would pay me to make political commercials for him. And I was good at it. No one wanted to pay me to write then. So I could work in campaigns kind of like migrant labor work, you know?
Migrant. How was your seasonal work years?
Yeah,
then?
So you go work for a couple of months in a campaign, make some money, and then have an off season to write. So eventually I got where I could get published. I could write books. People would pay me to write. But in the meantime, I had really enjoyed being a political consultant. And the secret of success for a political consultant is to work for people who are going to win anyway.
You're very modest in this book.
Don't screw it up.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky. I had good candidates. I was involved in a lot of winning races. And what happens, it's sort of like sports. You move up where the ultimate is to work in presidential races. And I ended up working in 5 presidential races, including the Bush campaigns, 2000-2004. I worked a good bit in other countries, which I found interesting.
Any countries here that do you have a list that you can just bounce off?
I worked in Israel. I worked in Albania. I'm huge in Albania, by the way. If you ever get in trouble in Albania, you get like a parking ticket in Albania, just call me. I'll take care of it.
My hairdresser is Albanian.
And
I still haven't been there, so I'm
there
protected in two ways there.
I worked a lot in the Congo, Nigeria, Philippines.
Yeah. Cool. The way you describe your way, your first meeting with Roger Ailes, what was the campaign situation that first time you met him, and how did that relationship split up? That I find that really fascinating.
Well, you know, Roger is someone who saw some of my very early campaigns and liked him a lot. And for reasons that probably should make me question, in a deep sense, my own character, Roger really liked me.
Yeah, the book is a redemption plot. We'll get to that.
He helped me out. He helped me work on campaigns. I made a film for him for the 1988 Bush campaign, for the convention. And he was sort of a mentor of mine, I guess you would call it. And when he got out of politics and was hired by Murdoch to Bill Fox, I remember having lunch with him in New York, and he had this very clear idea of what he was going to do. And I can remember he said, "We're going to call it Fair and Balanced."
Yeah.
And then he just sort of chuckled and then said it again. He
goes, chuckle is laughing in a dishonest kind of way for the Norwegians who don't know the chuckle word, but I can hear it inside my head.
Yes.
Because he had the plan for making a propaganda network already pitched for Nixon back in the early days, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you know, there's a brilliant book, if you haven't read it, you should, called The Selling of the President, which is about the 1968 Nixon campaign.
Yeah.
And the guy who wrote it, he wrote the Nixon campaign and said he was a graduate student and wanted to cover the campaign for his thesis. And incredibly, considering like how paranoid, weird Nixon world was, they let him inside the campaign. And he wrote this incredible
book
about the campaign.
We'll find it.
And that was when Roger Ailes, you know, Roger Ailes had worked in television. And he had been stage manager for a popular TV talk show called The Mike Douglas Show. And the story goes, he was about 30 years old, and he's basically almost like a stagehand, you know, behind the scenes. Mm. And Nixon was going on this show, and Nixon was talking to him in the wings of the show. And he said, "You know, I really hate television. I get really nervous when I do this." And Roger, who, if you knew Roger, this made perfect sense, said to Nixon, "That means you're never going to be president, you understand? Because if you're not good on television, you're never going to be president." And Nixon remembered this. And when he ran for president in 68, they reached out to him to help produce a live television event. And there was a question in 1968, could people trust Nixon? The whole Tricky Dick thing. Was Nixon, who is Richard Nixon? So Roger Ailes had this idea that when he talked to Nixon, he saw a guy that was smart, who was interesting. So he staged this event. It was called Man in the Arena. And it was a live television event to go out nationally at a time when there were only three networks, right? So millions of people would see this. And it was on a sound stage in Philadelphia, and invited, the idea was just to invite regular people into the audience, and they were sitting in bleachers, and Nixon was in the middle. And they would ask Nixon questions. It was ask Nixon anything.
Up to now, everything sounds perfectly media journalistic. What's happened?
So, you know, famously, Nixon had this chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, who later went to prison over Watergate, who had a buzz cut, famously sort of hard-ass guy. So it's like 5 minutes before they're supposed to go live. Haldeman is up in the control booth with Roger Ailes. And Haldeman starts asking Ailes, like, "So how did you pick these people? I mean, have you given them lines and what to say?" And Ailes was like, "No, this is for real. These are just regular people."
What?
And Haldeman freaked out and he goes, "What? You mean we don't know what these people are going to ask you? Nixon doesn't know what they're going to ask? And he goes, no. And so literally, Haldeman starts trying to shut the thing down, like get to the control panel and pull, like, you know, the levers to make the whole thing go dark. And Ailes, who had weirdly broken his ankle, so he was in this one of these big casts, they end up wrestling. And there's a scene that's in this book of Roger Ailes wrestling with Haldeman and Ailes saying, trust him, he can do this. I know the guy, he'll pull it off. And Alderman's like, stop, we can't do this. We're going to lose the red. And they did it. And it turned out to be a big success. And that was really Roger Ailes' first political campaign.
And this guy, he paid for your ads back in the, when you had the lunch and the meeting, you made some ad for the Bush campaign that they didn't want. And then he said, I'll make it anyway. Wasn't it? Didn't he?
Yeah. You know, we have these political conventions in America.
Yeah.
Sort of a tradition to show films before the candidate speaks and also before.
Romney's campaign movie in 12 legendary good.
Like a 10-minute film.
Yeah, it was really good.
And so they wanted, in the Bush campaign in 88, they wanted to make a film to show before the person, the keynote speaker, they call it, the person who would introduce Nixon was going to speak. And it was called American Heroes, which basically was people who were demographically correct, who had gotten rich during the Reagan era. It's really what it came down to.
Yeah, Reaganomics hero template. Yes.
So one of the key figures in this film was this Vietnamese-American woman who had started a catering company in Chicago that was a huge success and now catered United Airlines, the food on United Airlines. And she had gone to University of Chicago Law School, sort of this great American success story, Vietnamese immigrants. So we'd make this film, then somewhere along the line, someone realized that while she was going to the University of Chicago Law School, on the side to make money, she was working as a Playboy bunny in the old Hugh Hefner Playboy clubs. So this became a thing, and there was a pollster who was very close to Bush, and he was like, we can't show this. I mean, we're just saying there's like, you know, millions and millions of American women, and the only one that we can find that we're going to talk about is one that was a Playboy bunny.
Yeah, because the morale of the GOP electoral base was...
And Ailes was like, what's wrong with being a Playboy bunny? People love Playboy bunnies.
Yeah.
This is great.
They subscribe because of the writing.
Yeah, I mean, like, you think Playboy's not a success for a reason?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just this kid watching this play out. Then it turned out when they picked the person who was to give the keynote address, he didn't want a film. So the whole thing just went away. But it was my first entry into presidential politics.
I would obviously love to talk to you about Northern Exposure, but let's not do that because I'm not sure our election-interested audience will let me dwell 30 minutes about that TV show. But you rise through the ranks, and then you end up and you get the presidential campaign responsibility under Romney. What are the initial analysis? How do you build that process? Is it any way that you can describe to Norwegian listeners how you enter into that kind of task?
Well, you know, first you have to win the nomination, which Trump pretty much did yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very interesting when you look back. What do we know about the Republican Party now? It's very Southern. It's very Christian evangelical. It's very populist. And what do we know about Mitt Romney? He's wealthy. He's a Mormon, and he's from Massachusetts.
And very well educated.
And very well educated. Two advanced degrees from Harvard.
As well, so, it wasn't enough. And had the Olympics.
He was a
European celeb.
He was a very unlike. If you look at Trump, who won the nomination in 16, and look at Romney, who won the nomination in 2012, it would be very hard to find two more different people on the planet Earth than Mitt Romney and Donald Trump. Mitt Romney was always an unusual fit for the Republican Party. And there's a journalist named McKay Coppins, who has written a biography of Romney that came out this past year. It's very good, called Romney.
Mm. Yeah, he gave up all, well, he gave him all his notes. It's like, it was
right. Romney gave him all these emails, all these notes.
And there was no dirty secrets.
there were these emails from me that I'd forgotten I'd written.
Oh, were you nervous?
One of them was to Mitt, early as the before really the campaign started, me saying, you know, we're going to have to steal this nomination because you are not who the Republican Party would naturally go to.
That email? Is that in the book? Because I haven't read
the book. Yeah.
I'll have to buy that book too.
Cool. And a bunch of other emails. You know, my feeling about it was that you had to make the race about who could best handle the economy.
Yeah.
Because if that was the question, Mitt Romney, more than any of the other candidates, would be the answer. So our theory was, you know, Mitt Romney couldn't be the most conservative. He's not going to be the most anti-abortion. He's not going to be the most right-wing Christian. That if you were going
to
beat
Romney... Just educate the listener. It's the primary effect is that you have to be the most electable person to the right. That's a very... Very, yes. Very hard positioning balance. How do you do that? And this guy is then nowhere to be put naturally in the primary dynamics.
So our theory of the case was, if you were going to beat Mitt Romney, you had to beat him on the economy. That was going to be the ditch that we were going to dig and we'd be willing to die in. So it was hard, a long campaign, but he won the nomination.
What was the most difficult part until you won the nomination? I remember the self-deportation word. That's always one of the thing that comes up when people discuss the Romney campaign. But
let's just talk about that for a second, because it's sort of a crazy moment, because if you go back and you read the transcript, it was in a debate.
Yeah.
And if you go back and read the transcript of that debate, these other candidates are saying that, like Trump is saying now, that they intended to deport millions of Americans. Millions of people living in America.
Yeah.
Who are not citizens. Like, round them up with police, put them on buses, put them on planes, drive them over the border and dump them. Mitt was saying, that's crazy. You can't do that. What we need to do is we need to make the economic circumstances in their country, mainly Mexico, better so that people want to stay in their own country. And people are coming to America because they think they're going to have a better life. So what you really want is...
That's a very good cleanup. I mean, that's a really good point, because I lived through just MSNBC, CNN, all these podcasts, and obviously we tag self-deportation as one of the very few things that Mitt Romney said that was off the normal track. And I forgot that was his argument.
And he said, ideally...
In that context.
I said, you know, ideally, we'd like people to go back to their country voluntarily.
Yeah.
Because most people have family there. It's emotionally difficult to live here. Mm. That would be ideal. So he just used this phrase. We don't want to force people to deport. We want self-deportation. We want people to decide to leave on their own. And, you know, it was a weird phrase. I'd never heard him use it before. But it was one of these moments, like you're in an argument or you're in a conversation, and that's best described in the moment what he was trying to do.
Did you have a Holderman reaction? Oh, why did he say that? Can I pull some plugs? Or did you think that this is going to be a problem? Because you worked on you obviously know positive tools and negative tools. And you take things that people say and you spin as hard as you can. And yes, the Democrats spun perfectly with that word.
Look, every hour in a presidential campaign is a struggle.
That's what I'm so impressed by, the number of decisions and the number of things happening.
Yeah, and it's like sports in a lot of ways. If you take like a long match or game, you know, you're going to lose some days and you're going to win some days. And what you can't do is overreact to a bad day or a good day. And if you look at the best athletes, they're very calm. They're very focused. They know they're going to make mistakes. When they make a mistake, they don't dwell on it. They just move on.
Mm-hmm.
There's an expression they use in American football that was used by a famous coach of New England Patriots that was wildly successful for a long time. Play the next play. Move on. There's nothing you can do that undo. If you made, you know, if you kicked it in your own goal, you have to just move on. Because if you think about that, you're never going to be able to perform at your best.
Is this? I have like a Promilla campaign experience like you in terms of resources, but there the key thing is to make the best out of every decision because you can't redo the decision. And then you just have to push forward. When you 2012, it went how it went, and then you saw Trump coming down the escalator. Your book is about the conspiracy to end the democracy in the United States of America. You describe five elements. Before that, I just want to talk a little bit about the key events that happened now, the last just weeks, this arrest of this Russian agent Smirnov. Yep. Because I see Putin's people's influence campaigns, you know, their PSYOPs operations, much like they run it like an election, but with the toolkit is a little bit, they have more tools and there are some tools they can't use. And now, it's 1 week ago. No, it's 2 weeks ago. This guy, Smirnov, is arrested and he's a Russian asset and has been leaking for years to FBI. He's a paid informant.
Yep.
And he's been feeding the narrative inside Fox News, spreading the propaganda about Biden being a corrupt person and the Senate and the House of Representatives. How was your reaction when that came out? Did you say, obviously, that it was that?
Well, the degree to which, think about this. For decades, the single most consistent adversary of the Soviet Union and then Russia was the most conservative element of the Republican Party. That's a party that was defined by Ronald Reagan standing in front of the Berlin Wall saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, right? That was a bedrock. I mean, it was, if this was a religion, this was the resurrection. This was it. This is a key moment. Now, what has happened? That same group, the most conservative element in the Republican Party, is the pro-Russian element of American politics. It is the most extraordinary switch. It's as if Winston Churchill's party had become the pro-Nazi party. It's astounding. And it, we know that Russia supported Trump. Trump won. And what did the Russians get? Well, it turns out they got a lot. And if Trump wins, they may get Ukraine out of it, because Trump wants to cut off all aid to Ukraine, which would be one of the most disgraceful moments in American, probably the most disgraceful moment in American history. So I think that what people have to realize is a lot of this conservative element in the Republican Party, they look at Russia, what they think Russia is, and they like it. Putin says there's no gay people in Russia. They like that. It's all white men in power. No women. No people of color. They like that. Putin, you know, says he's a big Christian, even though the Russian Orthodox Church is run by KGB agents, former KGB agents.
Mm.
They like all of that. All of this stuff that Putin talks about, the decadence of the West, that is very much a thread of American conservative politics now. So they look at Putin, they look at Russia, and they're like, that looks pretty good to me. Why can't America be more like that?
In your book, you go through is it 13 chapters? I don't remember, but still, you constantly going back to the similarities and the differences in their authoritarian, I gave you the Norwegian one, their dream in the US and the Russian one. When did you see that the pivot was coming? Because it was kind of a surprise when the Russian elements were leaking as Trump was fighting to win the election. And some people thought that there's the Ukraine and the Ukraine connection with his campaign manager, and then his speech.
That's Paul Manafort. I knew Paul Manafort. Everybody knew Paul Manafort.
Yeah.
Paul Manafort, he was a pirate. He was out on the political seas under the Jolly Roger. Everybody knew that. I mean, it was, it's what he was.
But you must have seen the influence campaign flowing through the Trump campaign the first time.
When Trump went out in the 16 campaign and said, Russia, if you've hacked these emails, release them.
Yeah, that was horrible.
I mean, what do you say about that? And the idea that they had over 100 contacts with Russians inside the Biden campaign. You have to have worked in a presidential race to realize like how extraordinary that is. I mean, in any other campaign, Democrat or Republican, if someone, a foreign country agent, hostile foreign country, contacted you, the first thing you would do is call the FBI.
FBI first, and then you.
I mean, literally, you would hang up the phone, you would call the FBI.
Did you feel any, jump a little bit back and forth, but did you feel when you were running the Romney campaign, did you feel Russia was trying to do something in that election, or did you not think of it at all?
Yeah. No.
Okay. So then we're back with Trump, and Manafort has been fired, and we have the Roger Stone Twitter leak when it was happening to Hillary. We understand that there are massive campaign elements going on. I did not understand that, but I've read the books in the three states that somebody was reading the statistics and doing ads to polarize the three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And then the election results come and they were, Russians were there through social media. Do you think the Senate report saying that this election the Russians did not put their tongue on the scale when it comes to paid influence or that kind of influence. Obviously, they did with the Hillary email and the letter of Comey. Yeah.
I mean, this is a covert operation. So we don't really know everything the Russians did. I mean, we know a lot that they did, but we don't know what we don't know. And the hardest thing in politics is knowing why people make decisions. You know, what we call causality.
Yep.
Because if you ask people, people are terribly bad at explaining to themselves why they voted for somebody. And it's usually a mix. And the degree to which the Russians influenced the 16 election, we'll never know. I can make, if you put me in front of the Oxford Union and ask me to argue the case that the Russian interference in 2016 elected Donald Trump, I could make a very persuasive case. But we don't know.
No. Well, there are some elements that at least you make a good case. But I always, when Marco Rubio came with his report, I don't remember the number of pages, but it was a ton of lists that these are all guilty, these are in jail, these elements happened, and this is horrible, and it should never happen again. And Mitch McConnell gave $50 million to the election. Finally, some election protection investments. But I feel that, and this is an emotional because we don't know, a Senate report has to say you did not. Russia, our election worked. You did not get this win. But I think that's the official power statement by the U.S. government has to be that. I'll back you in the Oxford.
I think the most important thing about the Republican-led Senate report was they admitted that the Russians were trying to help Trump. Because for a long time, the story was the Russians just messed around in American politics to create havoc. They didn't really care. Clinton won. They didn't care if Trump won. They just wanted to screw with American elections.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened. They were very deliberately, carefully working for Donald Trump. And the guy who ran it is Prigozhin. You know, last seen getting blown out of the sky by Vladimir Putin.
Leader of Wagner Group, who's run the influence operations in the Brexit and the US, France, and Germany.
Yes.
When you did the pivot, my feeling of it is that they were ashamed that Trump was backed by Russians and that they were still anti-Russian for a while. And when the attack on Capitol happened and they pretended or hoped maybe Trump will go away, you described that brilliantly in your book, then Trump comes back and he's clearly not going to protect Ukraine, that he's not going to help them if he's a president. That's where I felt that the Republican Party will stand up to him, at least the Senate. And now where's no one?
No one.
Oh, well, apart from Nikki Haley, but now she's gone too.
and Christie. Nikki Haley will endorse Donald Trump. It's only a matter of when.
Let's then give her more attention and go move on to your book. Obviously, maybe I'll call you again and we'll talk about it was all a lie because race will not leave this election either.
Right.
But so there you describe the big driving force of the Republican Party and how race always have been the underpinning of most of the strategic choices, and the way of building the argument is through all campaigns and getting to power is motivated by that. But in this book, you describe how it is not the candidate, it is the movement, that it is a conspiracy, and you just say that it's five things you need to succeed at dismantling the democracy called the United States of America. What's the five, and how did you arrive at it?
Yeah. When you look at when democracies slide into autocracy, there seem to be five consistent elements that are necessary. One is the support of a major party, which Republican Party has become the Donald Trump Party, 100%. You need financiers to fund it. There's unlimited money for Republicans, unlimited in the American system. You need propagandists. Well, we have that. You have Fox News and a whole echo sphere of right-wing crazy media. You need a legal justification for it. So you need to change laws. So if, say, a state has a law that the state legislature can overturn the popular vote, when they do it, it's perfectly legal. And you need shock troops. And like those that turned up on January 6, 2021. And all of those elements are there. I think that we talk about them individually. I don't think we talk about them collectively enough.
Mm.
You know, one of the interesting things about the study of democracies becoming autocracies is it's not an obscure subject, and a lot of brilliant people have written a lot of brilliant work on it. And one of the hallmarks is usually you don't have coups that are violent now. It's not like Chile and Allende.
Mm.
You don't have tanks in the streets. It happens at the ballot box and in the courtroom. And that is the question for America. Will it happen in the ballot box or the courtroom?
And do we have some courtroom drama going forward? that is going to be hard. When you say you need a united political party, there are some fantastic descriptions on how that unity is built up, but they ended up with Donald Trump on top. And Donald Trump, there's 100 ways of this talking about him. Obviously, I think it's fun that you quote Steve Bannon, that he says is Archie Bunker, this TV personality that insults the inner morals of even Republicans back then. Could you describe why you liked Steve Bannon's metaphor and why it is wrong?
Well, you know, Steve Bannon made this reference. Archie Bunker was a character of a working class guy from Queens in a long running American sitcom that was written by Norman Lear. He's a fascinating creature who was very liberal, but a genius, and his correct belief was that if you really want people to listen to you, you can't lecture them. You have to use humor and storytelling. So there was the Archie Bunker character, and he was juxtaposed against his son-in-law, played by Rob Reiner, that he called Meathead.
Rob Reiner is legendary for a ton of movies. Spinal Tap is one of the most.
Carl Reiner's son.
Yeah.
Another legendary talent.
Yeah.
So a lot of this was about, it's called All in the Family was a show. And a lot of it was played out about the divisions in America over the Vietnam War. But it's not really an accurate description of Donald Trump, because the character, Archie Bunker, had a basic humanity. That was the whole thread of the show.
He wanted something nice for somebody else than himself.
At the end of the day, this is someone who could see the humanness of a situation. And he might have a racist reaction initially, but he could come around. Whereas Donald Trump doesn't have any of that. You read all these stories that Trump was a working class candidate. Well, Trump lost the working class. If you consider working class those that make under $50,000 a year in America, he won the white working class. And Donald Trump's coalition is 85% white. In a country, America is now 59% white, and less so since we've been talking. And I think race is at the heart of the entire Trump appeal. Mm-hmm. Now, when I get in these arguments with my old Republican friends, they say, you mean 70 million people are a racist because they voted for Donald Trump? And my answer to that is, well, first of all, there probably are 70 million racists in America, so let's don't like kid ourselves. But second, I don't think you have to be a racist to vote for Donald Trump. I think that you have to admit to yourself there's something more important than having a racist as president, because Donald Trump is a racist. And at the heart of this is white grievance. So here's a couple of statistics that are mind-boggling. 1980, Ronald Reagan gets elected president. Landslide, wins, I think, 44 states. He got 55% of the white vote. You go to 2008, John McCain loses to Barack Obama, not particularly close race. He got 58% of the white vote. And that's how America's changed. We are becoming a majority-minority country. But in many ways, we already are. If you are 16 years or younger in America, the majority are non-white. And odds are really good they'll be non-white when they turn 18 and can vote. Mm-hmm. So America is changing rapidly. And that is at the heart of this panic among Republicans, conservatives, because they are basically uncomfortable with the modern world. And, you know, they get into fights like Donald Trump and Republicans got in a big fight over the Nike shoe company because they supported this African-American athlete, Colin Kaepernick, who had protested police brutality against minorities by kneeling on the side of the field. So Republicans call for a boycott of Nike. What happened? Nike made $9 billion off of Colin Kaepernick. $9 billion. That's where the country is. It's not where Donald Trump is.
If you're going to... If you're going to head back to the U.S., not now, but let's see the way you work in Lincoln Projects nowadays as well. How do you guys work when it comes to the next month, the next half year? You have at least two audiences. You have the audience of one. You are making advertising where you try to get directly in under Donald Trump's skin. And how would you describe your other target audiences? Are you making most videos to mobilize, or do you have targets for demobilizing as well?
Our target audience in the Lincoln Project are those, what we would call soft Republicans, who don't like Donald Trump, but they are more conservative than Joe Biden. They aren't used to voting Democrat, but they aren't comfortable with being a Republican in Trump's party. And those are the people that enough of them voted for Trump in 16 that Trump won. Enough of them voted for Biden in 20 that Biden won. So they need to vote for Biden. And that's where our focus is. And, you know, with our crazy electoral college system, Trump lost by over 7 million votes. But if 400,000 people in exactly the right places had changed their votes, Trump still would have won. So.
Well, how do you, what's your battleground states? Where do you see now? Because my choice, where do you see them? Yeah, your biggest task is?
It's going to be Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada, North Carolina. That's where the election's probably going to be won or lost.
And you guys are not spending any money in Florida again? Or are you?
No.
No. What are the three ads that the people of Norway should see from Lincoln Project, and pick at least one from the last campaign and one from this effort? I'll have... what's the best speech that you didn't write, but you were in the campaigns watching from the other side?
I can answer that. In 2000, George Bush had a brilliant speechwriter named Michael Gerson. And there's a great misconception about George Bush that he's not an intelligent man. He has a need to appear anti-intellectual, which I think is unfortunate. But he's very, very smart. All he does is read. He's married to a librarian, for crying out loud. But Michael Gerson wrote a speech for him that he gave when he accepted the Republican nomination in 2000. And you should go back and read that speech.
Yeah.
It is like a document from a lost civilization. It is all about humility, grace, helping others. And you compare that to Donald Trump's speeches, and you cannot believe this is the same party. So Michael Gerson was a brilliant, brilliant writer. He went on to write for the Washington Post. Tragically died cancer about 18 months ago. But he was an evangelical Christian.
And your speeches, you wrote the concession speech, right? Mitt Romney's? When he gave the speech? Okay, then I'm just misremembering.
Mitt and I wrote together the convention speech that he gave in August of 2012. Yeah.
What's your other proudest speech that you can share?
Oh,
you're on a redemption plot, so it's hard to be.
I think Mitt Romney's announcement speech is a very good speech.
Yeah,
but look, you know, writing with Mitt, you know, he's a very, very good writer, and. You know, he wrote a book after the 2008 campaign. And as is normal, when they put the deal together, they hired a writer to help him write it. Mm-hmm. And they hired a guy I recommended that I went to college with. And they agreed to pay him, you know, X amount a month. And so after they started working on this book, after about a month, Mitt told him, look, I just want to write this. Is it okay if we just keep paying you?
Yeah.
And you can like do some research, give me some ideas. And of course, my friend said, yeah, that's okay. you really want to do all the work? Like, yeah.
That's super nice.
And he wrote the book himself. So, you know, it's writing, you don't write for Mitt Romney.
No. But that's not, but it's like I follow the speechwriters of Obama as well, and they say they hand drafts, but they get really writing back. So that it's not, it's rewritten.
Yeah,
in a good way.
John Favreau, Obama's a great writer.
Yeah.
We just did an ad. Called God loves a dictator, that is a takeoff on an ad. God loves a farmer, that the Trump campaign did.
It's really good.
Difficult to describe because it involves.
But we'll put it in our channel so people can see it. Because you're really emotional.
Yeah. It involves an American radio personality named Paul Harvey, who gave these famous God Loves a Farmer was one of his famous things. Mm-hmm. The Trump campaign used it as a takeoff, basically to say God loves Donald Trump because Donald Trump is God. And we mocked that. With God Loves a Dictator. We made an ad in 2020. Mocking Donald Trump and his COVID policy, scored to an operatic score of like a veto. Because Trump loves, like a lot of dictators, to go out on a balcony and give these speeches. So it was very funny.
Yeah, it was.
There's a guy who works in the Lincoln Project named Rick Wilson who makes ads. And I think Rick Wilson is a genius. So
he's a fast talker in a very good way. And he wrote the book, Everything Trump Touches Dies.
If you were going to read one book about Donald Trump, I would say read that book.
Yeah, I think I had to reread it because I read it many, many years ago, and now it's over Trump. I think Haberman also is one of the most detailed. This is where he's at. I think that was a very good sum up of Be Afraid. And my feeling of listening to you in different shows and podcasts is that you are not convinced, you know, it's a ton of work, but you feel Donald Trump is going to lose. Have I gotten that right?
There's this question you always ask yourself in campaigns. Would I rather be my campaign or the other campaign? And I would rather be the Biden campaign.
Yeah.
Now, could Trump win? Sure. And look, in 2016, a lot of people were wrong about Donald Trump, but it's really hard to find anybody who was more wrong than me. I didn't think he'd win the primary or the general. So I'm not sure I'm the best
reading your book, you're a very professional assessment of what's the strategic reasons why win and why lose. And there's so many things. There are some very good reasons why Trump should win. Biden's age, it's just natural that something might happen. There's some very good reasons why he should lose. So it wasn't by asking you to go into the prediction business, but the very thing you said.
In one simple way to look at this race is, Biden won by 7 million votes.
Yeah.
So to win again, all he needs is repeat customers.
Mm-hmm.
Trump needs new voters. So how many Biden voters from 20 are now Trump voters in 24? I don't think there's very many. There may be some that won't vote, but I don't think that Donald Trump is persuading new voters.
The most experts like David Axelrod, Mike Murphy podcasts, and the other campaign following podcasts says that Trump has a way better campaign staff this time around that knows what they're doing. Yeah. How are all those people going to stay there? Do they have the level of their work? Is it hard to compete with, or are they not batshit crazy?
Trump had campaigns run by crooks, fools, idiots, and some combination of being a crook, fool, and an idiot.
Yeah.
Including, you know, the prime example is his idiot son-in-law. You know, yeah. Son of a felon, Jared Kushner. He now has competent professionals. So when they say it's better, it's a pretty low bar. It's like saying, okay, the car isn't being driven by a drunk. It's being driven by someone who's sober. Now, that's different than saying the car is being driven by a Formula One driver.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
I know these people who are running the Trump campaign, known them forever. They're competent people. They're sane. They're not crooks. But they aren't geniuses.
Yeah.
So,
do they think that he's not going to?
They will not lose the race for Trump.
No, they're going.
But I don't think they will win the race for Trump.
Stuart Stevens, I have no shame, so I might contact you again as the events progress. I am eternally grateful for you being on this podcast, and have a great days left in Sweden. And you should look into coming to Norway next year, living here, if the events are going a bit in the wrong direction.
You'll have to adopt me. I'd like that.
Oh, easily. Easily. I will. This is the picture of my wife, your mother to be.
I will be a dutiful son. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All the best. Take care. Bye.
Det var første samtale. Jeg håper du satte pris på den. Jeg lover å bli flinkere. Og prøv å anbefale og gi anmeldelser og spre det store bildet til alle du kjenner som kan ha interesse av det. For det sånn denne podcasten vokser. Og det ønsker Eirik Bergesen sin slekt noe veldig at skal skje. Tusen takk for at du hørte på, og gled deg til både tirsdager og fredager fremover, så vil disse samtalene komme når vi finner mennesker og møter mennesker og får puttet det ut. Ha det godt, og takk for at du hørte på.
Du har hørt en podcast fra Podplay. En enklere måte å høre podcast på. Last ned appen Podplay, eller se podplay.no.